The Guardian.
This is The Guardian at the Edinburgh International Book Festival 2013 with Claire Armitstead.
So, we've arrived. It's day one of the Edinburgh International Festival and we've had our customary welcome from the Edinburgh Samba School. I'm surrounded by hordes of mainly rather small people. Whatever are they here for?
Julia Donaldson.
That's because they're how old your two children?
3 and 6.
I've come and see Julia Donaldson.
Do you like Julia Donaldson?
Yeah.
Yeah, you haven't grown out of it yet?
Not yet.
Who have you come to see this morning?
Kathy Cassidy.
Yeah, and why?
You both love to read girls, don't you?
Oh, well, you're very nice and early. Hope you have a good journey here.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. But the mood on the adult side of the festival is rather different. We're going way out west.
Colonel Eli McCullough, 1936. It was prophesied I would live to see 100, and, having achieved that age, I see no reason to doubt it. I'm not dying a Christian, though my scalp is intact, and, if there is an eternal hunting ground, that is where I am headed. There, where the river Styx. My opinion at this moment is my life has been far too short, the good I could do if given another year on my feet. Instead, I'm strapped to this bed, fouling myself like an infant. Should the Creator see fit to give me strength, I will make my way to the waters that run through the pasture. The Nueces River, at its eastern bend, I have always preferred the devils. In my dreams, I have reached the water 3 times, and it is known that Alexander the Great, on his last night of mortal life, crawled from his palace and tried to slip into the Euphrates, knowing that if his body disappeared, his people would assume he had ascended to heaven as a god. His wife stopped him at the water's edge. She dragged him home to die mortal. And people ask why I did not remarry.
One of the great things about festivals is you never know what you've got till you're there. It's all about picking up the buzz. Well, the buzz began to build a few weeks ago around Philip Mayer's second novel, The Sun, with the excitable pre-publication quotes from Kate Atkinson and Chris Cleave, to name just two. You heard the opening lines there. It's one of those big American novels that tells a big American story. Set in Texas, it sweeps from 1836 to the present day, taking in Comanche scalpings, the massacre of innumerable Mexicans, and the consequences of oil. Philip, welcome.
Hi.
First of all, I'm going to pick you up on the title. You call it The Sun,
yeah.
But it has 3 narrators, one of whom, and the most recent of whom, is a daughter.
Sure. So that's, of course, a play on this idea of the firstborn son inheriting everything, and also, in theory, the one who's supposed to carry the family name forward. And so in both cases, the son of Eli McCullough, who's the family patriarch, ends up being sort of his greatest enemy, the guy who, in the end, sort of undermines the family. And the person who carries the family name forward in the 20th century is a woman, and who's the last born daughter.
Peter, who's the son of the founding father, Eli, has this line quite near the beginning where he says, "This journal will be the only true record of this family." And he says that a couple of times. And I wondered how much you're playing with the idea of authority.
Yeah, absolutely. So I intentionally had Peter's work in diary form so that there's this idea, the sort of like bit of metafictional narrative in which there's the story within the story. And we have Peter claiming to be the major authority. And in fact, he is the moral voice of the book. But you know, whether he's a reliable narrator or not, that's sort of up for the reader to decide.
Your first novel, American Rust, was set in the Rust Belt in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Why did you choose Texas for this?
For me, anyway, the important parts of my work or my art comes from the subconscious. And so I never have a good logical or verbalized idea about the work I'm going to do. I always have a strong feeling. So for the American Rust, I began writing the book with one image of these 2 young men who were running down a set of railroad tracks in a rural area. I knew they'd done something terrible. I began writing the book from that image. For this book, I had a very strong sense that Texas was somehow important to the American narrative. And the more I researched, the more I found out, okay, this is actually true, and I discovered the reasons why. In the end, what this book is about the American creation myth. And you know, this idea of like where we come from as a people, this idea of the American dream, that which is fundamentally tied to the frontier, which is something that I now is quite clear to me. And when I began writing the book, was not.
And Texas had a particular place, didn't it? Because it was independent at the point at which you start the novel, wasn't it?
Yeah, so Texas was a country for 10 years, which, of course, modern Texans look back on this time as being a sort of amazing time in history because they didn't have to answer to Washington. In fact, they were bankrupt. They had no currency. The major currency in Texas during those 10 years of independence, which is 1836 to 46, was a cow. People traded in cows. Oh, you need this food? Let me give you one cow for that, because the Indians wouldn't steal a cow. Texas ends up joining the Union over the objections of all the northern states because it was a slave state. Up until the mid-1930s, all the entire economy was based on cotton. And even the entire economy of the West, the cattle were a very, very minor part. And so the idea of the cowboy as being the sort of like major part of history is purely mythological. The cowboy was, if anything, a sort of a harbinger of civilization. They were the people that arrived on the land after the Native Americans had been cleared off and been killed. And just before farmers arrived. So the cattle drives and the whole idea of a cowboy, this is something that it's an industry that actually only lasted for about 20 years. And it never in reality had the sort of economic or social importance that we ascribe to it now.
Nevertheless, as you say, it's created its own mythology, which you draw on, don't you? Because there's an awful lot of high chaparral in the early scenes when Eli is kidnapped by Indians.
Sure. What I'm trying to do with the book, if anything, is to put these sort of our mythology in a context. The people who actually settled the U.S. in terms of making it safe for Anglos to live there were the frontiersmen. They were generally lower class. They all knew they were moving to a combat zone. And if you sort of wonder about America's comfort with violence compared to Europe, comfort with firearms compared to Europe, this is because you know the entire continent was settled by us, the culture that you know lives there now, very, very recently. I mean, 1885, the frontier is still open. And so you still have a sort of external threat of Indians, you know, Native Americans. And you know, it was quite important to be armed or you weren't going to survive. And even the army, in fact, played almost no role in the settlement of the country.
And the relationship is very paradoxical, isn't it? Because on the one hand, these Comanches disembowel Eli's sister in front of his eyes. On the other hand, they then take him on and bring him up.
This was quite common. It's sort of hard to wrap our heads around now, but this is the Plains Indians' reproduction rates were quite low. Their food supply would be good one year, very poor another year. The mid and late winter were very hard because there were no edible plants left. They'd eaten up all the sort of potatoes and root vegetables that could be gained from the earth. If the buffalo hunts had not been good, they were probably running out of meat. And so, you know, a woman who's late term pregnancy would often lose the child and the children would die. So almost all the Plains tribes, this practice of taking captives to become sort of junior tribes members or as slaves was incredibly common. It was, in fact, crucial to keep their numbers up. Obviously, the U.S. government and whites did a fair amount of, you know, forcibly taking Native American kids and sort of trying to force them to live, you know, with the whites. That didn't always take. When Native Americans took white captives, if they were young enough, most of them were quite happy. Once they'd made it past 2 or 3 years, they did not want to return to white civilization. And there's something about whether it's they're living closer to nature, closer to the earth, even though it was a sort of brutal subsistence existence.
You've got quite a lot of research in this. How did you research it?
I read about 350 books, but there came a point in which I realized most of those books have been written by academics who actually did not feel or understand what life was like on the frontier, what life was like on the plains, what life is like for a society that's fundamentally almost a Stone Age hunter-gatherer society. I mean, you're talking about a society that is actually not that different in terms of the way they lived in America in, say, 1850 than Europe would have looked like in, say, 5000 BC. With the exception of the steel and, you know, guns, knives, things like that. I realized I had to learn this. If I was really going to write about this honestly and really understand, I would have to figure out, know myself how to track animals, hunt animals, you know, use a bow and arrow. I hunted and killed several deer with a bow.
You have an amazing author picture of you with a dead boar's head on the wall.
It's a boar's head. Yeah, so that's an animal. I ate that for about a year. It was a pretty big boar.
You shot it?
I shot it and ate it. So I took several weeks of classes on how to track animals, how to identify and sort of eat and cook native plants. I slept outside, sort of, you know, with no sleeping bag or tent, under the stars in most of the places the book takes place, quite a large area of Texas. So the buffalo was quite crucial to all the Plains tribes. It was both their general store and grocery store. They got tools from it, and they also, of course, you know, ate all the meat and all the organs. So I went to a buffalo ranch because I know how a deer smells in the wild, and I can tell the difference between a sort of rutting buck deer in the wild versus a female deer. I know the way a boar smells in the wild, and I also know what those animals smell like and taste like when they're sort of cut open and butchered. So I went to a buffalo ranch, and I ended up helping the rancher kill several buffalo, which were headed for, you know, organic supermarkets. As we're bleeding one of the animals, which I just shot, I had to sort of actually figure out what the blood tasted like. So I filled a coffee mug and...
Now, by the time you get to the 21st century, Jeannie is quite a sad character, really, isn't she? She was born in the same year as Howard Hughes, wasn't she? And she's a recluse, like him.
I think she tried harder than Howard Hughes did. I mean, I think she tried to have a normal life and made the choice that I think many very successful people make between having a family and having success and having a sort of control over her destiny. It's much harder to be a woman CEO than to be a male CEO. And, you know, this is fundamentally what Jeannie is. You know, she's running this big company. The sacrifices that she has to make to sort of stay on top of things are far greater than what, you know, a sort of male equivalent would have to make. And especially because she comes up, you know, in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, when women are absolutely not welcome. In fact, one female wildcatter I interviewed said that even as recently as the mid-2000s, she was not allowed to go to the sort of annual Wildcatters convention except as someone's date, even though she was very wealthy, very successful, very accomplished oil woman. So in some ways, the Jeannie story is based on that lady.
You're Texan. There's a romance about the old country, is there not?
There is, which has changed so much. So Texans are taught in the seventh grade for about 1 year of Texas history. No place else in America does this. So Texans are quite proud. They're also quite, you know, they're warm, gregarious, very kind people. It's quite a shock to live there, actually, after you've lived in the American Northeast, where people are sort of cold, they won't look you in the eye. Texans, you know, when you're driving down a back road, they expect you to wave to them, you know, from your pickup truck. So every person you pass on the road, you wave. Every person you pass in the parking lot, you sort of nod to or say hi to. But what drew people to Texas originally was that it was an incredibly lush country. It was mostly short grass and tall grass prairie, which is hard to imagine now if you've seen the state. It's quite dry. They used to say if you throw a nail on the ground, you know, you're going to get 10 pounds of nails are going to grow up out of it. This is sort of an example of how fertile the soil was. So it was absolutely overrun with game in terms of, you know, hunting. It was absolutely overrun with all sorts of edible plants. And between overgrazing by the cattle industry from about 1880 till about 1900, and widespread irrigation, which dropped the water table in some cases from about, you know, 5 or 8 feet below the surface to 500 or 1,000 feet, the state's completely dried out. I mean, it's the same thing that people did to the Middle East, and this is just what people do to the landscape. We dry it out, we use it up, and this was done to Texas in the span of about 75 years.
Finally, I'd just like to ask a quick question about style. You have three narratives. One is dictated by Eli in 1915.
Yeah. Sure.
Second is Peter, as we say, rather pompously saying he's telling the only real version of the story. Right. And then for Jeannie, you go into the third person. And these are interleaved all the way through. So it's not like you have one section, a second section, a third section. Yep. They're all sort of spliced with each other. Why did you decide on that structure?
Good question. The first book was written a bit like that as well, with the sort of interlocking narratives, changing points of view every chapter. And it's a structure I think is nice. It communicates something to the reader without having to say anything. You can create a certain structural tension just by having this character speaking in this voice, the next character speaking in this voice. You can have a dialogue between the characters in this way. Again, without you as a narrator ever having to write this, you're always comparing and contrasting what's happening with this person and this person, and then the next one. In terms of mechanically how you do that, I think the best way to do it is you write the novel through, you know, revise it a few times, and then when you sort of begin to hear the voice, you then break the whole thing down and write only all of the sort of Eli chapters all the way through to the end of the book. And then you begin again, write all of the Jean Anne chapters all the way through to the end of the book, and then write all the Peter chapters all the way through. I did not read the book as a whole all the way through until about 2 months before I finally turned it in. So I was only writing it as if it were three novels. I mean, I knew how the parts were going to interact, but it was not until, you know, I actually did not read the whole thing through till just before the final version was turned in.
Why does Jeannie talk in the third person?
So there's something that you want to do just as a favor to the reader. It's not usually enough to say chapter XYZ, you know, this person, you're now entering the mind of this person. You can do that, but people tend to get disoriented because they sort of read past that. So you actually do want to have like very different styles for each character because it's just a favor to the reader. I mean, it just allows them to process, oh, I'm now in the voice of this person. And frankly, we all have such different speech patterns, thought patterns. You know, the language we use is different, even if we, you know, technically speak the same language or even have the same dialect. So this is something that just reflects life better.
Philip Mayer there. And that's it for our very first festival podcast. Join us tomorrow for Roddy Doyle and the Ukrainian novelist Andrei Kirkov.
The Books Podcast from Guardian.co.uk.